This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. Joining me today is Daniel Hamburg, a politician, activist, and environmental campaigner who served 2 years as a congressman in California's 1st District from 1993 to 1995. His experiences include serving on the Mendocino County Board of Supervisors for 4 years, coming third place in California's gubernatorial election in 1998, and being named one of People magazine's sexiest people on the Hill during his time in Congress. He is currently executive director of the Voice of the Environment at voiceoftheenvironment.org. Daniel Hamburg, it's an honor to speak with you today on the Corbett Report.
Well, I'm very pleased to have a chance to talk with you.
Well, as I say, it is an honor to be talking to you today, as you have had an incredible range of experiences, which I know myself and I think my listeners, too, would like to hear more about. But today I want to concentrate specifically on a topic that you wrote about quite powerfully in an article for the San Francisco Chronicle in February 2008 entitled Rule by Fear or Rule by Law. And for listeners out there who have not read the article before, I'd like to quote the opening paragraph, if I may. Quote, since 9/11, and seemingly without the notice of most Americans, the federal government has assumed the authority to institute martial law, arrest a wide swath of dissidents, citizens and non-citizens alike, and detain people without legal or constitutional recourse in the event of an emergency influx of immigrants in the U.S., or to support the rapid development of new programs, end quote. The article then goes on to lay out point by point much of the infrastructure for the implementation of martial law in the United States, including, of course, the setting up of detention camps, the passage of key legislation like the Military's Commissions Act of 2006, and the use of fiat decree by the White House in the issuance of NSPD 51. Mr. Hamburg, why don't you go over and break down some of this architecture of martial law that has been slotted into place with such alarming speed over the past 8 years?
Well, you know, it really started, when did it start? you know, a lot of the what you might call the infrastructure for martial law and for extra-constitutional powers being taken on by the federal government really goes way back. I mean, certainly all of your listeners are, you know, are students of history enough to know of the detention of the Japanese during the Second World War. You can go back even further than that to the Alien and Sedition Acts in the first part of the 20th century. So, you know, historically the federal government, you know, or go back to Abraham Lincoln and his suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War. So, you know, there's a long history in this country of the suspension of constitutional rights. And, you know, certainly we saw it during the Reagan administration with Oliver North and his REX 84, which stands for Readiness Exercise 84, which was basically a plan to round up citizens and non-citizens alike who might object to a major U.S. incursion into Central America to stop governments that were forming in Central America, particularly in Nicaragua, that were thought to be unfriendly to the United States. But if you look at the last 30 years or so, the two outstanding figures in this area of the executive taking on extraordinary power in a situation of national emergency or even, you know, national, well, you have to say national emergency as declared by the federal government. The two outstanding figures certainly are Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. And these two go back as a pair, certainly to the Ford administration and, you know, throughout the Reagan years, the Bush years. Of course, they kind of went into an incubation period during the Clinton years, but it was probably during those years that they were really kind of honing the kind of structure that they could put in place when they had the pliant kind of personality that George W. Bush obviously was. And I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the Project for a New American Century And the document which they published at the very tail end of the Clinton administration, which they called for, but stated that it would take a Pearl Harbor-like event to galvanize the American people and make them amenable to an aggressive U.S. foreign policy that would further secure the imperial hegemony of the United States. And of course, lo and behold, it wasn't very many months into the questionable presidency of George W. Bush, and forth by questionable, I'm referring to the debacle in Florida and the fact that, George Bush is our only president who was actually put into power by 9 Supreme Court justices, most of whom had been appointed by Republican, by conservative Republican presidents. And lo and behold, on September 11th, the very event that PNAC had been forecasting, or at least mentioning as just what the doctor ordered, occurred when the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were attacked. On September 14th, 3 days after September 11th, George W. Bush declared a state of national emergency. That national emergency has been renewed every year since September 14th, 2001, most recently on August 28th of 2008. And it's my contention that under a state of national emergency, you have a situation in which the president has almost unlimited powers in terms of what he can do to contain civil unrest, detain people at his whim, and basically call to his put under his control all aspects of national life.
Well, of course, I think you're absolutely correct in your assessment that, of course, this is not the first period in American history where subversions and contraventions of the Constitution itself have been attempted. And, of course, it goes back at least to the time of Lincoln. But I think the incredible pace and rate of change over the past 8 years is, if not unprecedented, at least unprecedented in modern history. And I'd like to concentrate a little bit on the reason for that. In the article, you start by saying that since 9/11, this has been going on. Do you think this would have been really possible without an event like 9/11?
Well, I don't, but I do look back to those Clinton years and that strange event at the Alfred Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, which actually led to the precursor of the Patriot Act. Now, I don't know who actually bombed that building in Oklahoma City. Obviously, there's still a lot of question about, Timothy McVeigh's role and who he really was. But I guess what I'm saying is that I don't see the George W. Bush era as this, everything was really kind of cool in America, and then George W. Bush became president, and it all went to hell in a handbasket. Because it just ain't real. And, even the 2 years I spent in Washington, D.C., kind of looking at the belly of the beast, so to speak, informed me to the reality that American foreign policy, for example, is a bipartisan effort. Bill Clinton, throughout his 8 years in office, continued to bomb the nation of Iraq on a weekly basis, and Bush took it one step further. So I'm not willing to let Bush's, those who came before Bush off the hook, but I will basically agree with your contention that post 9/11. Things sped up at an alarming pace. But again, I want to point out we're now in the Barack Obama era, and we have before us a bill introduced by a Democratic congressman from Florida calling for the establishment of FEMA run detention centers six of these detention centers on military bases in the United States. We also have, for the first time since Reconstruction, the stationing of U.S. troops under the U.S. Northern Command within the borders of the United States. And these are troops that, you know, were trained in Iraq to do crowd control, traffic control. So basically these, in my mind, this is a very ominous development. It's a violation of posse comitatus statutes. And furthermore, it's just the beginning. I mean, we've been told by one of the commanders of this branch of the military that at least two more brigades will be stationed within the continental United States by the year 2010. So I think the government, and Obama's government, no different from the Bush government, is anticipating dissatisfaction on the part of the citizenry and preparing for it in the only way that they know how, which is by force.
It certainly is a scary development, and I think that's an important point that we need to tease out a little bit. For those people who still believe in the Barack Obama Hope and Change administration, could you speak a little bit more to that point of the continuity between the Bush policies and the Obama policies?
Well, you know, clearly we're seeing some encouraging things. I mean, just this week we saw the Obama administration take the position with, I think his name was Al-Mari, the man who had been held for 5 years within the United States without any due process. We had the Obama administration call for him to be tried in an American court. We had Obama signing an order banning harsh interrogation techniques. We had Obama saying that within a year, he plans to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay. But at the same time, those who follow these matters closely know that there's three times as many prisoners currently being held in Bagram, Afghanistan, without due process. I haven't heard anything about how the Obama administration... Well, actually, I have heard something recently. It was just last Friday that the Obama administration made clear that they would not change the Bush policy on open-ended detention of those prisoners at Bagram. You know, I mentioned this horrible H.R. 645, which is named the National Emergency Centers Establishment Act, which is a bill that calls for the establishment of these so-called FEMA centers on military installations. I think that's absolutely frightening. But the only member of Congress who has raised a stink about this, and I had an article about this in the Chronicle last week, is Ron Paul, who is, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of Ron Paul. He's a Republican from Texas, a physician, but he seems to be the only member of the House of Representatives who looks at this stuff and goes, now, wait a minute. What is going on here? Why are they planning to place American citizens on military bases unless what they're intending to do is forcibly detain them? So, on the one hand, I was cheering for Obama. You know, I was glad when Pennsylvania came in that election night, and I knew that John McCain was not going to be our next president. You know, I'd probably been on the next plane to Japan to join you over there if John McCain had been president. But on the other hand, I think people, Americans are so complacent and so ahistorical and so apolitical, and Americans will follow a demagogue. And, you know, your excellent podcast on mind control really, really pointed to that fact, and I hope all your listeners have listened to it very carefully, because we are very susceptible, we being the people of this country, are very susceptible to dangerous leaders who will promise us the moon and take away our liberties.
That's absolutely right. And we do see all of this architecture being slotted into place right at the moment. And the question obviously becomes what next, or what could come of this? And in Rule by Fear or Rule by Law, you ask the rhetorical question, what could the government be contemplating that leads it to make contingency plans to detain without recourse millions of its own citizens? So in your assessment, what are some likely answers to that question?
Well, you know, for a long time, I thought it was going to be an attack on Iran. I mean, I thought that, you know, in February of 2003, just before the Iraq War was declared, millions, I don't know how many millions, but millions and millions and millions of people all over the world, including in the United States, were out in the streets. And it takes a lot to get Americans out in the streets. You know, I was just talking about how complacent they tend to be, but I really thought that if this country, probably in collusion with Israel, were to launch an attack on Iran, and I totally believe that Dick Cheney was trying to take the country in that direction, and it's probably only because of Bob Gates that it didn't. Well, not only Bob Gates, but you know, I think there was definitely some pushback. I thought that would be an event that would create it, but I think now we have a much larger event, and in a sense, it is an event of the government's making, and not only of the government, but of the elite that controls the government, and that is this this financial meltdown, which really has people freaked out. And you know, again, I'm sure your listeners are paying attention to it and, you know, reading the stuff that Nouriel Roubini is putting out and that Joseph Stiglitz is putting out and Paul Krugman and James Galbraith. And, you know, there's some very good economists out there who are saying we ain't even close to the bottom of this yet. And people get very nervous when they can't get to their... you know, when they can't pay their mortgages, when they can't put food on the table, and for good reason. And social services in this country, you know, I don't know what it's like in Japan, but here, you know, where I live in rural Northern California, you know, social services are stretched to the hilt. You know, layoffs are pervasive. We're facing, you know, in California, we're facing the third year of a drought. The governor just today declared a state of emergency on that front. So there's just a lot of forces kind of coming together in a way that you know, these things, you know, can lead to social explosions. And I think the government's, maybe any government's first concern is its perpetuation. And this government, for many years, has been preparing to make sure that not so much the democracy as the corporate capitalist system is not brought down by the dissatisfaction, let me say, of the common people.
You've made a number of important points there, including, of course, that the financial crisis is being engineered, that the government is controlled by a faction of elites, not by the people, and that there are continuity of government contingency plans which ensure the government's success even in times of economic meltdown. I guess the question that might help to tie some of those points together is, how do you think that the economic crisis may in fact play out into a situation of civil unrest, and then extrapolating on that, what do you think will be the likely outcomes of the government actions in such an environment?
Well, you know, I fear the, you know, I really fear the worst if people become so desperate that they begin to take to the streets and protest and become active in that way. And I think anybody who has watched the increasingly aggressive stance of police forces, city, state, and federal, Most recently, I think we saw this in Minneapolis, where the Republican National Convention was happening, and police, you know, really ran amok, going after people that were not even demonstrating, but were thought to be potentially, you know, people who might be disruptive. I don't think any of us can forget what happened in Seattle in 1999 and what's happened at subsequent WTO sites. I mean, what I'm saying is that the police are becoming increasingly hard-nosed, and I think people who are willing to take to the streets of America will have to be ready to deal with, you know, with very very aggressive action to contain them and control them, and perhaps to detain them, and maybe to detain them for long periods of time. So there's that. In terms of how this economic meltdown is going to play out, you know, as I said before, I don't think we've really seen the bottom of this by any means. I don't think we've seen the you know, all these credit default swaps and the derivatives and the, you know, all these fancy financial instruments that are out there that some economists say represent you know, $100 trillion, $200 trillion. There's a lot more hell to pay, and every day, you know, when we turn our computers and you know, look at what's going on around the world, there's always a dramatic new story. I think today it was the story of Citibank and needing another major infusion of federal dollars. And when you're talking about the largest banks in the United States basically being zombies, being walking dead, and, you know, it's led to this whole major discussion in this country about whether the bank should be nationalized. And now you even have people like Alan Greenspan and Senator Lindsey Graham, who's a, you know, rock rib Republican senator from South Carolina, you know, talking about the need to nationalize the banks. I mean, these guys are scared. I mean, I think the elites are very, I think the elites do not have a handle on this. And I think Barack Obama really showed his hand, and at the same time kind of showed the limits of his wisdom when he appointed, you know, basically Clinton retreads and people who are responsible for this meltdown to be his, you know, the leaders of his economic team. I'm talking about Tim Geithner, I'm talking about Larry Summers, talking about this whole crew that was just as enthusiastic about deregulation as was Senator Phil Graham of Texas and some of these right-wing Republicans. So there's plenty of blame to go around. But in terms of Obama, I really fear that he is the captive of the interests that created him. I mean, I think I heard you mention on your program that, you know, how does a guy go from being an Illinois state senator to being president of the United States in 4 years? That doesn't happen unless there's, you know, a very big confluence of money and heavy hitters behind him. And I think in Obama's case, a lot of it is the Trilateral Commission, you know, Brzezinski, and, you know, it's a different branch of elites than those that put George W. Bush into power. But all the same, those elites share a lot. And one thing they share is the idea that the United States is a hegemon and that it is our right and our responsibility to be the dominant power on the face of the earth.
Well, if Mr. Hamburg, if American society is so clearly headed down the wrong track at this point, then in your own words, what is at stake here, and what can the average American or even foreign citizen do at a time like this to help derail this hegemonic agenda?
Well, you know, I think, I know it sounds a little bit wimpy, but I think the number one thing that people need to do is get educated. Because if you don't know what's going on, you don't have a prayer to stop it. So, you know, that's why I think the kind of thing you're doing and, you know, that a lot of citizens are creatively utilizing the internet and all these new tools we have is absolutely critical. I mean, people have got to, who is it that said eternal vigilance is the price of liberty? Patrick Henry, I think, or maybe it was Tom Paine, I'm not sure, but eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. And if people don't know what's going on, they're going to be abused. And what little bit of true freedom and democracy we've had in this country is going to be extinguished. And I say what little bit because I've never thought of this country as being particularly democratic. This country has, in my lifetime, you know, had some kind of good days when the economy was good. You know, I was born in 1948, and, you know, certainly the 60s were, well, let's not even get into talking about the 60s, but I mean, economically, you had a middle class that was thriving, and there were jobs, and, you know, kids could think that they would, you know, have a decent opportunity to own a home, and, you know, those things are not really there anymore. So I think number one is to understand the history of, you know, of our country and of our country's relationship with the rest of the world. And I think the other thing is to prepare yourself in your own life as much as possible to live without the whole corporate overlay that so controls our lives. And I mean stuff like planting gardens, like you know, if you've got the wherewithal, you've got a piece of property, you know, build a chicken coop, get some chickens, get yourself as self-sufficient as you can in your own life, and more importantly, I think, in your community, because I think there is going to come a day when we're going to have to learn to be much more self-sufficient in order to survive, and I don't think that's all bad. I think a lot of values that have been dormant for many years will come back into a more prominent position, and I think there's some hope in the world changing in that way.
I certainly agree with you, and I would like to add that I don't believe those ideas are wimpy in the least, because those are the very two ideas which I support wholeheartedly in each and every podcast that I do, is self-education and self-sufficiency, which I think are absolutely two basic building blocks to a free and truly democratic society. Well, Mr. Hamburg, stepping back for just one moment, earlier in our conversation you mentioned the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 and some of the questions that still surround that event. But obviously one of the at least to the public, one of the key factors in the building of our current political climate, it was 9/11. Mr. Hamburg, what are your thoughts on the joint congressional and senatorial inquiry into the events of 9/11, also the public citizen, the public commission into 9/11, and the official theory that it was committed by Osama bin Laden and 19 hijackers?
Well, I think the whole thing is a whitewash. it's pretty obvious, and you know, there's some excellent documentaries out there. There's some excellent books out there. A man that I admire very much, and I've had the honor to get to know a little bit, is Peter Dale Scott, a professor emeritus at UC Berkeley, who wrote an excellent book called The Road to 9/11, you know, which really explains how 20 years of U.S. foreign policy have created, you know, the very terrorists who, you know, supposedly now wish to do us so much harm. Chalmers Johnson has also done a great job with his trilogy, including the book Blowback, which explains, how it is that the United States so methodically goes about creating all these enemies who wish to do us harm. You know, I don't know who. I don't know who bombed those buildings. I doubt very much it was a guy in a cave in Afghanistan. I think if you look at the you know, the issues of thermite and thermate, and you know, I've seen the presentations of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, which I think is an excellent group, and they thoroughly debunked the idea that that jet fuel could have melted steel columns and brought buildings down in an 11-second free fall. There's absolutely no explanation for why World Trade Center 7 went down. It was never hit by anything and went down like a pancake. There's also no way that a commercial airliner hit the Pentagon, because the hole, simply is not big enough, and there was no fuselage or anything else on the ground. So, there has to be just an incredibly gullible public to take any of this this government BS very seriously.
All right. Well, Mr. Hamburg, do you have any final points you'd like to make on the points that we've raised today?
No, I think only, and it gets back to a point that I think you raised in your mind control podcast, which is that it's just really important right now, in particular, when President Obama is getting a bit of a honeymoon, and people are so relieved to have George Bush, finally gone back to Texas, to really keep a close eye on things. And I have a lot of concern that that Dick Cheney and his little cabal are not totally out of the loop as much as we wish that they were. I don't think they're officially in the loop, but I think that they are still lurking in the shadows and have the wherewithal to cause a good deal of mischief. And when you hear things like former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, making jokes about nuclear bombs falling on Chicago and getting rounds of applause, I think you've really got to worry about, whether these neocons, are really down for the count.
Absolutely. Well, Daniel Hamburg, how can people find out more about you and your work?
They go to my website. They can. My email address is on there, and I'm an email freak. So, if anybody's so moved and wants to communicate with me, they can do so. voiceoftheenvironment.org, and I'm here in Mendocino County. I feel very lucky to be living in a beautiful place and a little bit out of the out of the urban sprawl just south of me. But if you're in the neighborhood, give me a call.
I certainly will. And Mr. Hamburg, it has been a pleasure talking to you today, and I'd like to thank you. And definitely, I'd like to have you back on sometime in the future to talk about your work with Voice of the Environment. So thank you very much for joining me today.
My pleasure.